Okay. I want to thank everybody again for coming today. This has been a lot of fun for us trying to plan these Writing Life series. So if anybody has any thoughts, comments, feedback, suggestions for future programs, please let us know because we'd love to continue this. In the back, as you can see, we have the rest of the season already planned out, March through May. I hope I'll see all of you at those programs as well because they're going to be a lot of fun. So we're really looking forward to it. So today, I'm really excited to have Bill Finkelstein here as our speaker today on screenwriting. And as you all know, Bill is an Emmy Award-winning writer and producer of some of the most outstanding drama series of the last 20 years. And I'm talking, of course, about L.A. Law, Law & Order, Murder One, NYPD Blue, and the list goes on. There's Civil Wars and all these programs that we've watched and loved. And it actually struck me as I was talking to Bill this morning that I should have asked him to bring one of his Emmys with us with him today, because I actually personally have never been up close to an Emmy and would love to have seen what it looks like. But maybe another time we'll do that. He's just finished working on a screenplay, or actually, which is in post-production now, I guess, with the director Werner Herzog. So that movie will be coming out sometime this year, which will be really exciting. And so I hope he'll tell us a little bit more about that and what that's been like. And he'll take some questions afterwards. So so welcome, Bill, and thanks for coming.
I thank Mark and Carolyn for asking me to do this. I have a very good feelings about this building because I work here a lot, and so the air gets sort of thick with your own sense of sitting in the right chair, you know, with getting something done. I thought maybe I would talk to you a little bit about the progression that I had, or you know, how this all happened. Because I have wanted to be a writer for quite a long time, and you know, it's always interesting when you look back on you know, how things happen. There's a large a component of randomness to it, and sometimes I think that I know with television and movies, they're very attractive for a lot of people to work in them, and quite often there's a sort of an approach of how one does it, and I think that in some ways those are perilous questions, because how one person does it is so often utterly inappropriate for another person. And I you know, so having said that, I guess I'll just tell you the story, because you know, it has just because it happened, and I guess it's in some ways somewhat amusing. I got out of college and I wrote in various forms for a while. You know, I lived out in San Francisco. I wrote poetry. I was around the kind of post-beat poet scene and got to know a lot of those guys, and was completely destitute at the time. A more or less of an embarrassment to my family. But I sort of liked it, and it was a completely an unstructured existence. You know, I painted houses and I hung around, and the material deprivation did get to me, but I sort of did thrive on the creative stimulation that was going on out there and the people that I got to know and learn from. And I kicked around for a while, and I worked at different jobs, and I tried my hand at, I started wanting to write for the movies. And I would go down to LA from San Francisco, and I was shameless. I was as irritating. When I think of some of the things that I would do to advance myself, I shudder with humiliation, because I felt like, well, this was what was required of me. You know, I would write. I remember writing to John Cassavetes and whoever I identified as having some admirable trait. And, you know, I love Cassavetes. I thought he was a visionary, and think he's a visionary director, and changed movies. And I threw myself at him. At a certain point, I found myself living back in New York, and I wrote this movie, you know, all of this for no money, no agents, nothing. And I wrote a movie about an art dealer. And I had seen a picture that Sidney Lumet directed called Just Tell Me What You Want, which was a very good movie with Alan King and Ally McGraw. And Jay Press and Allen wrote it, and I think it's one of Lumet's better movies. And I thought, well, Alan King is perfect for this. You know, he's exactly who should be playing this guy. So I knew, I don't know how, but I knew where he lived. He had a house in Kings Point out in Greyhound. And I said to my girlfriend at the time, here's what we're going to do. You're going to bring the script to his house, because it's less threatening than if I bring it. So, you know, she didn't know anything about the business, and she said, all right, I guess if that's what people do. And I had a job, I was plastering a guy's walls who lived on the west side, who was an honest to God screenwriter, still is, and he's a friend of mine now. He had written some movies, and he was a very serious and erudite man. And I told him this plan, thinking he would embrace it as, wow, that's a great idea. And he got this pained expression on his face, which I have come to know quite well. And he said, don't do that. Don't do that. That's just not the way things are done. I know Alan a little bit. I'll write him a note and bring it to his office. So I did that. You know, I took the script. I wrote him a note per my friend. And I brought it over to, he was on East 53rd Street. And I brought it to his office, and I left it. 24 hours later, I got a phone call, and I had a secretary's voice, and I have Alan King for you. And you know, when you look back on your life, there'll be moments that will almost evanesce out of everything else that you've experienced, because it was from nothing. You know, it was from outside. You know, from that state of having your nose pressed up against the glass, having all of the kinds of nagging doubt and insecurity. What are you doing? This is silly. You know, this isn't going to happen for you. And you know, people would reinforce that, because I would regularly get updates on the percentage of screenplays that were written versus the ones that were sold, and what the mean income of members of the Writers Guild was. And I always knew, ignore it. It had nothing to do with me. You know, that was an article of faith that I held fast to, that none of that was applicable to me, whether it was or it wasn't. I wasn't, you know. But Alan King got on the phone. I heard that voice that I had grown up hearing on the Ed Sullivan Show on Sunday night, and he said, yeah, this is pretty good. Why don't you be, when can you be in my office? And I was just sort of, nothing really can be an exact equivalent of that. You know, I mean, all kinds of good things have happened to me, but that has a special place, you know. And I showed up at his office, and we spent about a year. Nothing came of it. You know, I think I did two drafts of the script. I think maybe he threw me a grand. He would pontificate about drama and the essence of things. I mean, the important thing for me was that something happened rather than nothing happened. And that was, at that moment, an enormously valuable event. When my first child was born, Alan sent a gigantic stuffed animal to the hospital. And I remember, like, the other women who had given birth in the rooms, you know, they saw there was a note from Alan King. So there was, it sort of bestowed a kind of a vicarious celebrity on me. You know, everything I needed to happen, it happened. But it would be a number of years before anything actually of substance went on. And that was that I had gotten I had sort of despaired of making a living. I went to law school at night. I got my degree. I was working. My folks were lawyers, and I was not well suited to being actually having a real lawyer's job. So they let me work in their office, which was an act of great kindness and indulgence on their part. And I wrote a play. And the play was based on an evening I had been at the office, and my mom was a pretty powerful lawyer, and I had seen her conduct a settlement negotiation with another woman attorney, and something about the scene struck me. You know, there was something about it that I thought had some dramatic life to it, and I wrote this play. Not having any idea what I was going to do with it or what I could do with it or any of that, but I was writing, you know, I was making part of each, pretty much each day, that, you know, and I had managed to get myself a young woman to represent me who was a fledgling agent at a legitimate agency out in Los Angeles, and she was rather intrepid and got that play to, I should back up a minute. This was in 1986. And that summer, the New York Times Magazine section had done a piece on a new TV series that was going to be coming out in the fall from the producer of Hill Street Blues. And there was a photograph in the magazine section of the writer's room. And I remember, like it was yesterday, looking at the picture and saying, look at these mutts. Look at these talent-free hustlers. As much resentment as I felt toward the world at large was all directed on that photograph. They don't know about lawyers. I grew up with lawyers. I hear lawyers in my head. This is going to be another show. So that was the summer, Labor Day. I think I'd gone away for a weekend. We had one baby, we had one on the way. It was like a two-room apartment. And there was a message from this young woman agent. And she said, are you sitting down? Stephen Bochco read your play. And he wants you to write a freelance episode of L.A. Law. Which I don't think I even understood at that point what kind of shot that was, because L.A. Law was about to take off. You know, it was about to be an honest-to-God hit, and they had gotten rid of most of their writing staff, and they were really scrambling. And Steve and I didn't know who Steve. I mean, I knew who Stephen was by reputation, but I didn't know him. So they called me, you know, the following Monday, and they said, well, you know, we want you to do this. Play's great, and so on and so forth. We're going to send you some scripts, and we want you to familiarize yourself with the show. The show wasn't yet on the air at that point. And, you know, there's a, just as a brief digression, there's a story, maybe apocryphal, that a chemist, a biochemist, had worked his whole life on a genetic project, and he went to sleep one night and he had a dream of a serpent swallowing its tail, and when he woke up he understood the molecular structure of DNA, and the thing he said was that visions come to prepared spirits. And so that was the way I think I was at that point. Not because I was so brilliant or because there was all any kind of design or intention, but because I did in fact have lawyers' voices in my head. I did have a significant amount of time spent writing various things. And so when they sent me those scripts, and then they got on the phone and they said, well, this is the kind, we know we want to do this kind of story in that episode. I wrote it. I didn't wait till I got to LA. I wrote it. I decided I was going to walk in the door done, because I thought this is the shot. So I wrote about 17 pages of a script, and I had a little typewriter. This was kind of pre-computer, and I typed on a plane. I had finished it. I had this little portable, and I had to go in the back of the plane because I was bothering the person sitting in front of me. So I came out there, and you know, they send you first class tickets per the Writers Guild contract, and which of course I cashed in for coach tickets and made about $2,500 on that. Right? I was ahead of the game. And you know, they were paying, I think, a freelance script was like $25,000. That was a year's wages. So they were paying for a rental car, I rented a Thunderbird, I drove to the 20th Century Fox lot, which was Valhalla. You know, this was, for me, I had been there once before because I knew a guy that was a successful writer, and I'd gone to meet him for lunch. And, you know, the smell of eucalyptus still transports me back to that very day. I drove on the Fox lot, and they were in a building that's called the Old Writers Building, which is this beautiful gabled building with a clock in it on the back part of the 20th Century Fox lot. And I walked in, and there was Stephen, you know, kind of pastel-colored sweater, spotless sneakers, creased jeans, Porsche out in front, just everything I could have expected. Couldn't have been more gracious. I handed him the 17 pages, you know, and he said, I thought we were going to sit down and talk about this. I said, well, you know, you said a couple of things on the phone. Jump out ahead a little bit. So we had scheduled to meet the next day. I was staying in a motel called the Tropicana, which isn't there anymore, which is sort of LA's version of Chelsea. It was a kind of louche place in West Hollywood on Santa Monica Boulevard. Drove up there, go to my room, and the phone was ringing, the motel phone was ringing, and it was Steven, and he was calling me from his car. And he basically said, you know, you'll never really understand the way what I'm thinking right now. That this is, you don't know how good this is. So that was it. I mean, they asked me how fast I could write, and I basically I wrote a script in about 5 days at the Tropicana, and they moved it to be their Christmas show, and I got nominated for an Emmy, and that was it. I mean, I haven't stopped working since, basically. And it was very heady, and Stephen is has been a great friend and is an enormously generous man and draws people to him and holds them there because he was conditional in his praise and his support. He was genuinely happy, and that's a rare and important distinction. Frequently, there's a threatening aspect to somebody coming along. And a lot of times people in his position have to reduce you a little bit. They have to get you. So, well, it's kind of good, you know, there's some good stuff here, and we're going to work on it together. And then, because God forbid I actually knew what I was doing right out of the gate. And of course, it wasn't right out of the gate, but Stephen wasn't like that. Stephen was happy. Because Stephen liked to leave work at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and go play tennis. And if he had somebody whether it was David Milch or David Kelly or myself who was turning out work that he was proud of, then that made everybody's life better. And so he was a great boss to have. And it also, that kind of reception, which was, you know, I would wish on anybody for its sheer thrill, also had a real unknown to me, at least, a danger attached to it, which is that you think it's always going to be like this. And so what they did is, you know, they hired me. They had an option on the contract, and my wife was in school at the time, and they let me live in New York and write two more episodes, and then I had to move out to Los Angeles, which we did lock, stock, and barrel. You know, we took a train out for some unknown reason. And we moved to Los Angeles, and I started working. You know, I had F. Scott Fitzgerald's old office on the Fox lot, and I was a writer. You know, I was a story, they call you story editor, you know, you're a writer, and television has a punishing pace. It is a relentless kind of an engine. Every 8 days, another script starts production. If you're late, it costs tens of thousands of dollars. Calls just, there's an instantaneous panic in the highest levels of the studio and the network. You aren't allowed to be late, you know, and there's people reading every word you're writing. It's a very high pressure environment. And it was, at first, terrifying, because when I wrote my second script, I waited, you know, when did they strike up the band, you know, like they did the first time, and there was no band, and there was Steven standing out of my outside of my office with a face like death, saying to me, this is piss poor. This is. And I thought, oh, God, you know, we all had those dreams of kind of waking, you know, I'm in Yankee Stadium and I'm naked. Why didn't I get dressed before I left, you know? And that was it, you know. I felt like they I tricked them once, and I can't keep tricking them, you know. I missed, I meant, you know. So what you sort of, what is necessary, I think, is that you don't dwell on your previous triumphs, and you try to, you can be happy for them, but you have to let go of them. You know, television forces you to keep working and to let the well fill up as much as it'll fill up, and then you're forced to, you're forced to develop your craft if you're going to stay in it, because ultimately it becomes as much about craft as inspiration. And you know, on days when you're not inspired and you're depressed or whatever other catalog of woes that, you know, we bring to it, you have to make that about your craft and not about your character or your spirit. And that sees you through. And I was very lucky to be on a show like that, which was very much of a writer's show. Steven believed that the script was everything. And it was a hit. Let us not forget that had something to do with it, because they leave you alone. You know, that this was a very heady and rare kind of a moment in television. It has existed at other times. I don't know that it exists now. Networks are much more powerful now, or much more willing to use the power that they've always had. They were much more deferential back then. You know, Steven had a very kind of, he was viewed as, he walked on water. And so their notes were taken or ignored per our consideration. That doesn't exist anymore. casting was, we cast the shows, you know, and the network just kind of went along with it, and that doesn't exist anymore. That they would have to, there were principally three of us who were writing it. It was myself and David Kelly and Jacob Epstein, and we would eat lunch together every day, and the studio executives that were handling the show would have to ask permission to come and talk to us. You know, that does for sure doesn't exist anymore. So it was a great environment to learn in because, you know, it was just all about the words and it was all about the characters, and the actors were thrilled. They were on a hit show. They had pretty good material to work with. I made a lot of mistakes. I think that the biggest, if I had to say, there was the single biggest learning curve for me was that when I have a good ear and I'm very quick with dialogue and I with characters, I have a harder time with story, with plot and with story. And because I think it fit neatly into my own proclivities, what I viewed story as a rather pedestrian consideration. You know, I felt like, well, who writes, you know, James Patterson's good with story. You know, these are airport books. This is the kind of thing that people just leave them behind. There's nothing here. And it took me about 10 years to figure out that was a fundamental misapprehension of what it was that I was supposed to be doing. Because so much of what I wrote had a component of solipsism to it. It was that I was in love with dialogue, I was in love with the characters I created, because they came very easily to me. And I wasn't necessarily giving anything to anybody else. And what plot ultimately does, if you embrace it, I think, is that it is the vehicle by which you allow the rest of the world in. And so I stopped looking down my nose at it. It became, for me, a much more, I still struggle with it. I'm still, you know, there's times when I will kind of have to really work to get it, more so than I have to work to get a line of dialogue out. But that's work that I got to do, you know. And in fact, I was thinking I might actually, if you indulge me, I was rereading The Last Tycoon, for those of you who haven't read it. It's a wonderful book. And you know, Fitzgerald had a very unhappy existence in Hollywood, which he wrote some of the most caustic and hilarious stories called the Pat Hobby stories, so most of them at the Fox Lot. There's a little passage here. I just indulge me. This is Monroe Starr, you know, was the kind of Irving Thalberg character, has a writer, an English writer, come in and Starr says, granted your dialogue more graceful than what these hacks can write, that's why we brought you out here. But let's imagine something that isn't either bad dialogue or jumping down a well. Has your office got a stove in it that lights with a match? I think it has, said Boxley stiffly, but I never use it. Suppose you're in your office, you've been fighting duels or writing all day, and you're too tired to fight or write anymore. You're sitting there staring dull, like we all get sometimes. A pretty stenographer that you've seen before comes into the room and you watch her, idly. She doesn't see you, though you're very close to her. She takes off her gloves, opens her purse, and dumps it out on a table. Starr stood up, tossing his key ring on his desk. She has two dimes and a nickel and a cardboard matchbox. She leaves the nickel on the desk, puts the two dimes back into her purse, and takes her black gloves to the stove, opens it, and puts them inside. There's one match in the matchbox, and she starts to light it, kneeling by the stove. You notice that there's a stiff wind blowing in the window, but just then your telephone rings. The girl picks it up, says hello, listens, and says deliberately into the phone, "I've never owned a pair of black gloves in my life." She hangs up, kneels by the stove again, and just as she lights the match, You glance around very suddenly and see that there's another man in the office, watching every move the girl makes. Star paused. He picks up his keys and puts them in his pocket. "Go on," said Boxley, smiling. "What happened?" "I don't know," said Star. "I was just making pictures." You know, the genius of that, and the genius of adapting what is so much in your mind in a literary fashion to the screen, be it television or movies. There's a wonderful piece in Schulberg's book, What Makes Sammy Run, where he's talking, he tells a sort of apocryphal story about the early days of sound pictures. And they brought these playwrights out from New York, and the playwrights, they had to write a scene. It was like an early director, like King Vidor or someone like that. And they needed a scene that stood for the notion that a husband was tired of his wife. And so the playwright wrote a 15-page scene. And Vidor reads it and says, "This is a great scene. This is a great scene." I'm not going to use it in the picture. But I think as much as I love all the dialogue and the speeches, the way I think I'm going to do it is I'm going to have the husband and wife standing in an elevator, and the husband's going to have his hat on, and they're going to stop at a floor before the first floor, and the young woman's going to get on the elevator, and then the husband's going to take off his hat. And I think that's really all. And you know, you when you're in it, it's also one of the things that is what happens when you work with directors who are good directors, or you work with actors, and you start understanding the language of the moving image, and that it's different from the language of the written word. And it's one of the reasons why frequently great books don't translate particularly well into great movies. Because what makes them great is what we do with the words in our imagination versus what we do with the images that we see with our eyes and what we hear with our ears. And so that was a process of learning of that and seeing what worked. And I can't tell you how many times I would sit in when I was starting out, we were still screening dailies. Now everything's digitized and they edit on computers now. They used to edit film, and these were the last days of that. And we would screen dailies every day, and you'd sit in the screening room, and there would be scenes that I would have been in love with that I had written, dialogue that I would have fought to the death to keep every word, and I would cringe watching it on the screen. Cringe. Think, what was I thinking? How could I? And you know, part of that is that you're moving in a very rapid clip. You don't really have the component of time, particularly where you put things down and pick them up again. But part of it is the hubris of the writer doesn't know better, and that's something that you kind of have to get taken down little by little. I had the pleasure this summer of working with Werner Herzog, and I wrote a movie, and the movie was being filmed out in New Orleans, and Werner hadn't really worked with screenwriters for the most part. He'd written his own scripts, and so it was a little bit of a departure for him. And one of the things that was very illuminating about it was a feature director like Werner, who's made 40 movies and has a very very developed sense of spontaneous creation on a set. He wouldn't have shot lists. He wouldn't come down there necessarily knowing what he was going to do. He would look at a setting. He would think how he felt, and that's the way everything would proceed. And you would see how visually your work would translate into a film, you know? And it was different than television. Television is much more of a writer's medium. It's the bosses in TV shows are writers. for the simple reason that they need a script every week. And they don't need a script every week when they make movies. They got the script. So at that point, you're basically, you know, as long as you don't bother anybody, I'll let you stay there, but that's about it, you know. I had a little bit more purchase on this because Werner liked me, and Werner doesn't talk to anybody. You know, he had everybody was terrified of him. He liked me. We became friends, so I became the conduit by which the producers would communicate with Werner. When they wanted to ask him to do something, they would tell me, and then I would have to go and have the conversation. those, I think, are... there are real differences writing for TV and writing for movies, but I think that there's a lot that they share in common. I don't think the process of writing is particularly different. I think, you know, you encounter the same dramatic problems in both. You got to tell a story in both. You got to feel like you believe the people, that they're truthful in both. And so, you know, is the act structure different? Is the scope of the story different? Yeah, but to me, those aren't profound differences, you know. I wrote a movie a year and a half ago about a congressman from Ohio, real guy named Jim Traficant. I don't know, some of you may know who he is. And a friend of mine was telling me, as a producer, he kept saying, you know, there's a movie in this. And we had a mutual friend as an actor who comes from Youngstown, which is where Traficant's from. And we would just be entertained regularly by the lore of Youngstown, which is a very unique and truly hard times region, you know. And at a certain point, you know, I found myself kind of without that much to do, you know, and sweating, you know, because things go up and down. And I didn't have a TV show on the air, and a couple of projects had fallen through, and, you know, the big fear factor was looming large. And I said to my friend, all right, let me write the Traficant. So I went out, he said, okay, you know, so we struck the deal. I spent about a month reading newspaper articles. The paper out there is called The Vindicator. And I would read all these copies of The Vindicator. I went to Youngstown. I got to know some people that were that knew Traficant very well. And I wrote this movie. And I'm going to read you a scene from it, which started at a dinner conversation. But HBO bought it, and we just found out on Friday, you know, because HBO is sort of a little bit of they're in transition right now. And we had kind of always wanted to make it as a theatrical movie, so we just found out Friday there's a fairly big Hollywood entity that's buying it to make it as a theatrical movie. I'm going to read this, and I'll just tell you a little bit about, you know, the relationship between the fictional work. Cal, I don't know if am I going long or
no, you're fine.
Am I all
right? Yeah, you're good.
So this is Holiday Inn Ballroom Day. Traficant. The other guy in this scene is a guy named Don Hanai. Hanai, who I spent a lot of time with in Youngstown. He was the political boss in Youngstown. He was a Democratic Party county leader. He was a lawyer, a very tough, very powerful guy in the Mahoning Valley. Traficant is at this time a United States congressman. Traficant's on the dais with several Rotary Club types, among them Hannah. There are people seated at tables having had lunch, now turning their attention to the speaker, Bob, prosperous farmer and fundraiser. Excuse me, Bob. It doesn't happen often that you send somebody to Washington who remembers where he comes from. With this guy here, you don't have to worry about that. It's my privilege to present Congressman James Traficant from Ohio's 17th District with a check for his reelection campaign in the amount of $10,000. ballroom responds with raucous applause as traffic cam steps up to the microphone. Traffic cam. See, this brings me to my knees right here. Because it's not some rich guy writing this check. It's bake sales. It's bake sales and car washes. It's putting off the trip to Disney World. Patching the roof instead of replacing it. We're on short rations here. We've had our livelihoods taken from us. And even with that, still, they can't piss on our heads and tell us it's raining. There may be a couple of profanities in here. I'm apologizing for things. Why I voted no on most favored nation status for Red China. Why I stood up to them on NAFTA. Why? Because it is, holds the check along. But I don't just carry your dollar bills with me when I go to Washington. I carry your hearts. I carry the spirit of people of this valley, and that's what gets me through. I am so goddamn proud to be from here. A supporter calls out, "We're goddamn proud of you, Jimbo." Spontaneous applause as Traficant stands there wet-eyed for a beat. Then Traficant, Bobby, Traficant takes the microphone from the podium, walks over to where Bob is seated on the dais, hands him the check back. Traficant, divide it up. Bob, it's for your campaign. Traficant, don't worry about the campaign. Put it back in their pockets. Let it be a present under the tree, a carton of cigarettes, some goddamn thing. Bob to the room. Is he something? As those present come to their feet applauding. Traficant, God bless you. Angle on Hanai's place on the dais. He's gone. Cut the interior men's room. Traficant enters to see Hanai zipping up. Traficant, how long you been in here? Hanai, you gave the check back, I know. Traficant, no good? Hanai, doesn't matter. Traficant, sounded like it mattered to them. Hanai, the feds are getting ready to nail your ass to the wall. Traficant, this is news from the front that I got enemies? Hanai, you don't qualify as an enemy, you're a case file. Traficant, yeah, good, Don, I'm a case file. Hanai, you think they're not talking to the people who work in your office? Tony Bucci, the JJ? Traficant, so they're talking to them. So what? Hanai, it ain't like with the rodeo clowns where you taunt the bull and jump in the barrel. Traficant, you know, Don, I'm getting a little tired of clown references. Hanai, you gotta get your house in order, Jim. I'd have the various contractors doing work on the farm generate invoices. I'd set up a payment schedule. Whatever members of your staff paid money, I'd have a committee to reelect, give them a receipt. Traficant, you're not proposing anything fraudulent, I hope. Hanai, still a joke, huh, Jimmy? Traficant, whether it's a joke or it isn't a joke, I'm the one's got to live with it. Hanai, yeah, that's right. Traficant, right, so spare me the sky's falling commentary. Hanai, you got it. Traficant, and while you're at it, drop them a line over to Father Flanagan's Boys Town. Maybe they can send you somebody else to adopt instead of me. Traficant exits. Interior hotel kitchen. Bob goes over to receipts with a couple of other Rotarians. Traficant enters, grabs the check from the table in front of Bob. Traficant, give me that fucking check. Traficant walks out past the stunned Rotarian. Now, it's based on a true story. The dialogue is all invented. But the wonderful thing that happens in the course of writing this movie, and I never met Jim Traficant, nor did I ever want to meet Jim Traficant. And he is in prison at the time, but I didn't want to owe him this script. I didn't want to worry about how he was concerned about being perceived. He is not, he is a deeply flawed character. He is a deeply flawed human being. I think he is all of a hero in the sense of being a dramatic protagonist. And I wanted to be able to do that without obligation. So the thing that happens is that you take the gift of the reality of the man, and then you let it go, and then you create a completely invented universe. You structure it according to the dramatic requirements that the movie can encompass, which is as much subtractive as it is additive, and then you let stuff like that kind of come to life. And it was invaluable to me to have people who I could pick up the phone and talk to as I would almost every day that I was writing this, just to hear their voice, just to hear Youngstown, you know, to hear that cadence, to hear those A's and some of it you use, most of it you don't, but it all kind of goes into the hopper, you know. And I think that if there's I think one the greatest prevailing defect among a lot of Hollywood writers, it's the belief that they know more than they do, and that they can make stuff up just as good, and they can't, you know. They don't allow for it was one of the things that when I would run shows, you know, there was an enormous tolerance for inauthenticity. Mm-hmm. And it really permeates, you know. I mean, God, you just turn on the TV set, it's rife with that, you know, as is the movies. And it's a curable disease. It's not necessary. It's so much the hallmark of the writers that, you know, why one of the writers that I love is Theodore Dreiser. And one of the things that characterizes Dreiser is how detailed and how right he gets the stuff he writes about, how much he is steeped in the world of commerce and business. And because if that's what his protagonists do, you know, if you read The Titan, he's basing that on a real guy. And he understood the time this guy lived in. He understood what it was that he did. And, you know, people reading the book, they might not have understood all of those things. They might not have known the difference between bond offerings and the Philadelphia railway system, but it didn't matter. Dreiser knew that there was a taint of inauthenticity that he avoided. And I think that that kind of permeates all of your work. And I should probably talk, let you guys ask me stuff if you have anything to ask me. And
what's the main difference? Why aren't you drawn to theater? Is that a terribly different kind of thing that you...
I am drawn to theater. I
write for theater, a play.
I would say that I started out wanting to. I did. And I mean, that's what ultimately got me my work in television, was a play. I went back to, I've gone back to it a few times. I've written a few plays. I would say that a little bit it's the distraction of money. And taking jobs, whether in television or in feature films, that I get busy with. I think writing for the stage is glorious. I mean, I would always love to be able to do it again. I haven't enjoyed the success in it that I have in television or films, but it's not for either want of trying or want of desire. So when plays are great, you know, there's nothing like it in the world, and I read them, and I would very much want to. Particularly now that I'm back living in New York, and you feel theater is much more of a kind of vital part of the city than it is in Los Angeles. It definitely appeals to me, and I would love to do it.
Thank you, by the way, for the presentation. It's really fun. Do you have any thoughts about how you achieve authenticity in a voice that's bygone and not another century? I mean, when you can't actually listen to it, you know, call up Youngstown, I mean, if you can't call up the 19th century, and obviously one can read and one can sort of imagine and immerse oneself, but I don't know if you've got any, because, you know, that is the nub, is that
yeah.
sort of sounding, I don't know.
I think it's informed speculation in a way, and you know how you draw your sources from that. You know, I'm writing a movie now for Warner Brothers that's set in the 50s, and everybody in it is dead. And writing the dialogue is a little different, you know, and I guess I'm drawing on period movies that I had seen, and it's a very inexact thing. My friend did a series on HBO called Deadwood, and you know, he spent a long time reading primary sources. He went up to Deadwood. He read newspapers. He didn't want to read historical accounts because he didn't want to filter the things from that age through contemporary historians. So he read newspapers from the era. He used primary sources wherever he could. And he constructed a kind of literary recreation. Literary, to be sure, but it was at least informed by things that were as close to being contemporaneous as he could. And I think that's part of it. But I think, you know, a lot of it is also what you come to believe about that period of time, what you want to characterize it as, you know. And I don't know if the accuracy is as important as the conviction, if that makes any sense. You know, I mean, he took a lot of heat on Deadwood because it was a very profane show. And people said, well, people didn't curse like that. And what he said is, well, people didn't curse in Hollywood Westerns. People cursed all the time in the West. You know, at what we've mythologized about the West, nobody here was alive during that time. All we base it on are movies that we've seen. So, you know, is that accurate? I don't know. I mean, I don't think he knows, but I think he was able to make informed decisions about that. You know, he also based it on what had people read at that time. At that time, people didn't have college educations for the most part. People who were literate, the main book that they would have read was the Bible. So a lot of the speech was predicated on biblical syntax, and there was you know, sometimes greater formality in the way people spoke. You know, I think it. You know, you draw on a lot of different sources, and I think that what I wouldn't be afraid to do is to create vivid characters out of fear that they're somehow not accurate to the time. You know what I mean? I'm reading a thing for this Warner Brothers movie about, because some of it takes place at the racetrack, and there was a jockey in the 30s. He was in the late 30s, early 40s. And he came from, like, Utah. He was a farm kid. But he spoke in very formal English. You know, he would say, "I shan't pull that horse." Now, where did this kid get it from? Who knows? But he did, you know. So I think, you know, you oughtn't to be afraid of those kind of things. If they help your story, if they help your work, I take a lot of liberty.
I think on this point, before Arthur Miller wrote The Crucible, he went up to Salem and spent weeks and weeks and weeks in the library and just submerging himself in whatever he could find and researching and trying to have a sense of it the same way, the way words were written, the way sentences were formed.
I heard a story that Robert Caro is, I think, you know, he's a hero of mine. And Caro approaches writing history not unlike writing fiction. Not because it's not true, but he said once that he keeps a volume of Gibbon and a volume of Tolstoy side by side. And he reads from both, and he thinks that the great underestimation of literary of literary reputation is that Gibbon was not as great a writer as Tolstoy was. And Carroll rejects that distinction. Carroll believes that, that writing history is as elevated, and in fact the way he approaches it is exactly consonant with that. He brought, when he was writing one of the Johnson volumes, he brought an electrician out of retirement to come to Congress and change the bulbs, because Congress is lit differently now. It's lit for television. And when Johnson was serving in Congress, there was no television coverage, and so it was lit differently. And he had this guy change the light bulbs in the well of the House of Representatives so that Carroll could simply sit there and experience what the light was like. Now that is a great writer. You know, I mean, it's a great writer, not based on the fact that he had the electrician come in, but what he made of it is what is part of all of that care and specificity, and nothing was too trivial for him. You know. Anybody else? Yes.
Just in terms of the job market and the changes in relation to the web coming in.
Uh-huh. I have recently learned to read email, so. I think it's a question that a lot of people are asking. I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows what's going to work. I think that I know that Marshall Herskovitz and Ed Zwick did a series called Quarter Life, which NBC didn't do, and so they put it directly onto the web. And it was, I think, in like 8-minute segments or 10-minute segments or something. And, you know, it was pretty much, died without firing a shot. I mean, nobody really was interested in it. I don't know if that was because the form didn't work or because maybe these were guys who were writing about 20-year-olds who should have stuck to their knitting a little bit. I think that there's clearly a mechanism to deliver stories of some type, whether they're going to be abbreviated versions of television shows, you know, whether you're going to take an hour show and kind of figure out how to make it work in short bursts that people will watch in a sustained fashion. I'm not sure of all of that. You know, I don't think there's a direct transference. I think you have to make something that really is conducive to that form, you know, and I don't think everything is going to translate well. In the same way that not everything translates well from films to television. You know, films are big screen events still. They're made for that. And they're lit a certain way. And you show things more than you tell them. And in television, you tend to not light things that way. And it's a smaller screen. And there was always the complaint of all the directors of photography that they always hated the way the show was broadcast, because you would light it carefully on the set and then they would just saturate it when they showed it. Plus people watch it on TVs, and it tends to be a more narrative medium. You know, they tend to tell you what's happening rather than show you what's happening. I once wrote a set a scene on L.A. Law, Interior Union Station, night. And then I have the characters in Union Station in Los Angeles, glorious railroad station. And Stephen Bochco came to me and he said, it's a good scene. I'm just wondering, Union Station, do we really have to do this in Union Station? I said, well, yeah, because, you know, they're going from the ticket office to the bench and there's all... says, yeah, I know, I understand. Yeah, you know that the light Union Station to shoot the scene is going to cost about $150,000. I think we could do it in the office, don't you? So, you know, you tend to write to what it is that you're doing. The stage has its own set of problems and conventions and restrictions. And so I think that people will figure out what that is, also how people watch it. It's less and less true that people sit down for an hour and watch a TV show. They do some, you know, there's some shows that draw lots of people. I think that in some ways these trends don't only move in one direction. As much as there's a kind of, there's more and more niche of programming, you know, there's many stations and there are shows that appeal to vastly fewer numbers of people that are sustainable shows because it's everything's broken up. People also want to have a kind of common experience. There is a desire to watch what other people are watching. And so if the show hits, whether it's The Sopranos or what it is, you want to know what that show is that appears to be the interest of so many other people. So I don't think that one thing cancels out something else. I think there's a lot more of a variegated movement about those things. So, you know, I would say that the web is going to be one form, and I think people will figure out how to write for it, and it'll have an audience, and I just hope somebody can make some money on it. That's another question.
Yeah. You mentioned when you started out, you tried all forms of writing. You didn't mention specifically fiction, and I'm wondering if you think that the transition from fiction writing to screenwriting is a hard one or an easy one, or could you go now from writing screenplays to fiction, and what would that be like?
You know, I tried. I wrote a pilot for HBO, bought a pilot from me, and I wrote it. You know, they bought the idea, and I wrote it as a pilot, and it was about people building this dream house and their architect and their marriage and all of that, and they didn't do it. They passed on it. I did a bunch of revisions, and then they felt it was too rarefied, and they passed on it. And I was very taken with the characters and the world and so on, and I wrote it as a novel. It took, you know, a little while, and I wrote it as a full-length novel, 300 pages long or something. And I couldn't sell it. And, you know, I found the experience exhilarating. Truly exhilarating. I loved writing. I loved the freedom of it. I loved not having the compression required in writing for dramatic purposes, and the internal quality of it. I think it's the transition is hard or easy, really based on the writer's own propensities and the way in which they're very different. You know, they're really different forms. I don't know that most. I can't imagine that. There's a lot of novelists. I can't imagine would want to bother writing a screenplay because it dispenses with so much of what they do. Mm-hmm.
That would be a reason to do it too.
Well, as a challenge, or as a clearly there are monetary reasons involved as well, and also you have more control over it. You know, you get the impression that somebody like Philip Roth, when he sells a book, he sells the book, and you can hope for the best, but I don't think he gets terribly involved in the marshaling of the film. I think they're very different, and I think that what the one's gifts at writing one don't necessarily translate into the other. So I don't know, I don't know whether it's hard or not to go in the other direction. I've written vastly more dramatic stuff than I have fiction, and I love going in that direction. I don't know as well, you know, if I reversed it, how it would have worked. You know, Fitzgerald and Faulkner were not particularly good screenwriters. You know, they were neither particularly successful nor were they particularly good at it. I think that's kind of it. You know, at the same time, I don't know that I would find you know, screenwriters that were that had their, you know, great, that have made great work. I don't know what they would have done as novelists. I always, you know, speculate that Sweet Smell of Success is a favorite movie of mine, and it was written by Odets and Ernest Lehman. And, you know, Odets was a playwright, obviously, and Lehman was much more of a, he had been a press agent, and I think he was more of a screenwriter. But I always imagine that the poetry in the movie came from Odets, mm-hmm. because his plays are so poetic, you know, and his language is so poetic, and that's so much of the beauty of that film. Yeah?
Hi. I really loved your comment, the very first comment that you made about the component of randomness and things that happen. I very much believe that. But for an aspiring screenwriter who tends to be rather shy and who wants to be based in New York, could you make some comments about the need to have an agent, the need maybe to move to Los Angeles, the need to get out there and, you know, shape your script around? I mean, could you speak to any of those things?
Well, you know, agents are necessary because, you know, they're the ones who basically get your script read by the people who are in a position to do something about it. And it's the cycle is a self-perpetuating one because agents want to spend their time working for clients who make them money.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to be a member of a club that would have me
sure.
for a member. You know, it's that kind of thing. I think that L.A. is people have different experiences of L.A. I would want to be working while I live there. I love Los Angeles. I mean, I have very good feelings about the place. But it's a pretty isolating city. Much more in ways that New York is not. And so to live in Los Angeles without work is sometimes a kind of
sure.
not a happy experience. I think that as a writer, you have a certain freedom because you can develop your work and you can create your work absent a job, absent someone allowing you to do it, unlike an actor or a director. And so to that extent, I think that it's good to try to have something, you know, going. You know, I wouldn't worry about the shyness factor because I don't know that being obnoxious served me particularly. you know, all in, that really wasn't what got me anywhere. I think that, that you know, if your work, I guess, you know, the thing that your obligation is to sustain yourself to keep going and to write work that you believe in. And to you know, yeah, you got to do what's necessary. You know, you blanket the town. You send it to 12 different agents and hope that one of them reads it and sees something worthwhile. You know, that a young kid who's working in an agency, which is who took me on. I didn't have the big guy wasn't interested, you know. I mean, they wouldn't, nobody's returning phone calls. You know, that is all part of the thing. But, you know, this young woman, she didn't have, like, big-shot clients, so she saw something. She thought, maybe I could do something with this, so she went on a flyer. That's what you want to get. You know, you want to get somebody like that. And yeah, you do spend time cultivating people and trying to meet people, but you know, as somebody who dedicated much of his existence to that art form, I can tell you it didn't really, that wasn't ultimately what did the trick. You know, what did the trick was I wrote a halfway decent play, and it got to a guy who was doing a show about lawyers, which is what the play was about. And he thought, maybe there's something here. And, you know, I think that having a sense of the marketplace and what kind of movies are being made and who's doing what, you know, within limits, that's a useful thing to think about. I try not to be, I don't fancy myself an expert about what's getting made. At a certain point, I have to reckon with it. But that's not what I spend most of my time thinking about. And I think that you need to sort of wall yourself off a little bit.
Absolutely.
And work when you're working and not be thinking about, you know, is this a movie for Julia Roberts, or is this a movie for Maggie Gyllenhaal? And I mean, are those things important? Yeah, it's going to determine whether it gets made or not. But it's not your business, not while you're writing.
But do you have an opinion on things like Ink Tip or some of the other script?
What was that? Ink Tip.
Ink Tip, obviously not.
What is Ink Tip?
Ink Tip is the internet-based service where you can enter your script. I mean, there are loads of them at Nichols Fellowship.
You pay for that?
You do. I think you pay to upload it, but it's a nominal fee.
I don't know about those things. I would be wary of people that are looking to get your money. That's one thing I would be a little wary about that. I mean, I don't know about those things. It doesn't mean that they don't bear fruit. Mm-hmm. They might. There's a lot of conduits in, and maybe some of those are effective. I don't have any experience with them. I will tell you one thing that for me, when I would run shows and I would get vast amounts of scripts submitted to me, I tended to prefer people writing original material to writing what they thought I wanted to read. People would write sample shows. They would write, here's my version of CSI. Here, I found those to be less illustrative of a person's voice than if they just wrote something else that was theirs.
Absolutely.
So if there's a peril to trying to dope out what they're looking for. Now, you'll come soon enough to have to deal with it, you know, and at different levels, different factors are in play. You know, the movie I'm writing for Warner Brothers is a big studio movie. They need things that are different from a small independent movie, and they're not bashful about telling you that, and if it doesn't lend itself to that, it's not something they're going to do. So there are very real external requirements on these things. For the most part, the one thing that prevails over everything else is if an actor wants to play the part, the movie gets made. So if there's one thing that you sort of keep in mind as a screenwriter, it's that. Is this a role that an actor wants to play? Because at the end of the day, that's the only thing that makes movies. You know, unless you're franchising comic books or something like that, where there's some built-in kind of, you know, Marvel comics, then it doesn't matter because you got the comic book. But if, you know, this movie will get made, this Traficant movie, because the role of Traficant is a wall-to-wall role for an actor. So whether it's Sean Penn or Vince Vaughn or who it is, they're going to read that script and they're going to, you know, assuming all the other factors come about, they'll say, yes, I want to play that part. And that's how the movie gets made. And then all of the prevailing wisdom, political movies don't work, and, well, but it's set in Ohio. Insignificant. Doesn't make any difference. It's all just it's a lot of you know, after the fact caviling about what was Harvey Milk? Is that likely, you know, how many people would have said, who's going to watch that? Who's going
to
watch that?
So you've come full circle to an agent again, really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, an agent, you know, they sort of are the gatekeepers. And so, you know, unless you, if you don't know an actor personally to go bother them with a script, for the most part, those are agents talking. So, yeah, you know, agents are important. You can't live without them, you know. Yeah.
Thanks.
My favorite movies have been written by former playwrights, yourself. You're like a literary guy. I'm like the opposite. But do you know of, do you think it's possible for, I've written a couple of scripts. I haven't even gotten an agent for those yet. But do you think it's possible for someone who's not a playwright, not a so well-read like yourself, do you think it's possible for someone like that to be successful?
Of course. I don't think that there's any sort of preordained path to these things. And God knows, a literary literary backgrounds are widely disparate. I sound very literary when I'm speaking to executives at a studio. Believe me when I tell you that when I speak to somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, I sound like I have an eighth grade education. So it's, you know, these things are kind of wildly varied, and I don't think that there's anything that, you know, you come to it with what you come to it with, and your background is what it is, and that's what you use, and I reject any kind of there's no necessary and sufficient part of this in terms of what you need as an education or a background. You know, the movie business was started by people that barely spoke English. Those were the guys that built the studios. Those were the guys that made all those great movies. Those weren't great intellects. Those were garment center
hustlers.
Huh?
Thurriers and glove makers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Goldwyn was a glove maker or a furrier. I mean, those were the guys that built it. They were entertainers. They were guys who had theaters and wanted to stick something in the theater beside a comedian and a stripper.
Yeah.
Could you comment on the difference between writing for drama and what you see on comedy? In any way, specifically on television. The writing is so different than
yeah.
I think it's so
it's different. I don't, you know, I've half hour comedy is those writers are a different breed for the most part than dramatic writers, and it scares me, quite honestly, because I tend to look at drama as being more subjective and more varied. You know, in comedy, if you don't laugh, it's not a funny joke. So comedy writers, they're, I don't know, I know a lot of them, and they're really funny. But they're a little bit ferocious as far as the way they approach it. You know, they kind of run through stuff really quick. It's a different rhythm. It's a different, you have a different end point. I think that some shows that are comedic also break out of that mold a little bit. Larry David does a half-hour show that's very different than the half-hour show that, Everyone Loves Raymond or something like that, which is a much more traditional half-hour comedy. I've written, dramas, but I've written dramas sometimes that there were very funny things in them, tending to be more character-driven funny than set-up joke funny.
Right.
So there's a different calculus to the way you're writing stuff. But that's more about, I think, when you're writing half-hour, you're writing stuff that has a familiarity. There's a form to half-hour comedies. There's a rhythm to the way the jokes play. You know, they have all kinds of, I was just telling this to somebody else, there's a there are terms that comedy writers use. There's something called a Stan Daniels turn. Stan Daniels is a big comedy writer. And there's a thing where, you know, somebody says, I will never, ever go to that butcher shop again. For the life of me, I will never walk in there again. Cut to, what's the address? You know, that's the Stan Daniels turn. Because they've used it 100,000 times. And so, you know, all of those kinds of conventions, they put them in various places. I would be terrified to do that. I tried to write one comedy pilot with a guy that's done a lot of them, and I found it altogether daunting. But comedy writers feel the same way about
drama. Yeah, and how about, to me, a show like Desperate Housewife, which I think is comedy, and I think most soap operas comedy.
Right.
Yeah,
but you know, it's more character driven humor than it is jokes. It tends not to be as broad, although I guess it can be pretty broad, you know, on its own. But you know, I wrote some stuff that was pretty broad in dramas. You know, we like to juxtapose sad and funny a lot. So there was, you know, it's. You know, they're different. They're different. Yeah.
I've been told not to go too far forward with the agent part until you're absolutely prepared. And so you have your script, and then you have the pitch and the synopsis. Is there some kind of formatting, and the agents expect this and that may be...
You know, they expect it to look like a script. I mean, that's fair to say. But I don't pass that. I don't think so. I mean, not that I've ever heard of, you know. But I wouldn't worry about things like that.
Great.
They're just not that important.
Great.
They what they're interested in is that they read something they can sell, and you know all of that rest of it, the rules and all that. I mean, there's a range of length. You know, if you come in with a 250-page screenplay, it's going to look a little long. But, you know, somewhere between, you know, whatever it is, I don't know, 90 and 125 pages or something, you know, you're in the ballpark. The computers all set the margins a certain way. I write in longhand, so I don't have, like, a lot of familiarity with... I mean, I type it eventually, but the first pass is always in pencil. So I just, you know, I go with that. Yeah.
Could you give us a couple of examples of how your movies came to be? How they emerged in your mind?
How they came to be in my head?
You chose.
Well, the movies that I'm doing now started out external to me. In other words, someone came to me and they proposed something, and it whether it was a remake of a movie that already existed, which I watched and then had a sense of how to reimagine it, or an idea like this Traffican script. I've written movies on spec that started out just in my head, and usually they started out with a character. They usually started out with wanting to find a story to encompass a particular person.
And that character, was it your invention or based on some person you observed or what?
I would say a little of both. I would say that it, you know, you kind of create characters that are amalgamations of yourself and of people around you. You know, I wrote a movie about a lawyer who was a drug addict, and that was based in part on myself, but also in part on kind of a fancy, you know, of like, well, if I were like this, You know, if I had this kind of life as opposed to this kind of life, and yet I had certain internal characteristics, you know, I think you tend, even when you're writing about real people, they're not, it's not really that person. It's your imagining of that person. And so I think that when I've created characters that I hung a script on, they would be characters that might start out in one place, and then I would kind of grow them. You know, I would change them or speculate on them a little bit. You know. I have a close friend who's a retired detective, and I spent a lot of time with him, New York City detective. And so I've written a lot of cop stuff. He's often where I start because I know him very well. I've spent many, many hours with him, and so I have a sense of him. You know, I know the way he orders food in restaurants. I know the way he reacts to 10,000 different things. So it's a good multi-purpose starting point. That doesn't mean I stay with him. You know, I change him because I'm not writing the same character all the time. But it's a good place to start. Because I have both the familiarity and the kind of intimate awareness of the guy, and because he has done many of the things that are similar to what you're writing about. So I think that's how, you know, that for me, that's a kind of the way I work my way in. Yeah.
Sort of a follow-up question. Do you know how you're going to end when you start?
Sometimes, but not always. Sometimes they want you to know. When you're doing a contracted job, you know, there's a movie I'm writing now that I spent a lot of time in conversation because they wanted it to end a certain way. I wanted it to end differently. And I basically conceded the point and I said, you know, let's see where we are at the end of the movie. I try not to be too certain about those things because you want to write them. You know, you want to let that go and be available to what strikes you at the end of the movie. I don't know the movie as well as all that before I start going. But that's part of what writing is for me. There's a book that's on this list that I think Callan's put together. It's a volume of a publication called Backstory, and I think it's number 3. I was fortunate enough to get to know very well a man named George Axelrod. And George was a wonderful screenwriter. He wrote the 7-Year Itch as a stage play and then as a script, Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter and Bus Stop and Breakfast at Tiffany and The Manchurian Candidate. And George would always say, you know, if you know the ending, what's the point of writing a strip? You know? So he sort of had to keep himself engaged. So I don't put too much story.
It seems to me also the powers of observation, the experience that is lived from day to day, and how well we observe and remember. And a lot of it is visual.
Absolutely.
Along with the buildup of vocabulary.
Absolutely, it's visual and it's experiential, and you know, it's one of the blessings of a place like New York is, you know, you go out on the street and there's so many lives coming at you at any given moment. You know, there's so much voices. You know, perhaps more self-incriminating than I want to be, but when I moved to Los Angeles, there was a device going around that some friends of mine had that I got, which was they would go into Radio Shack and they would pay $400 for an illegally modified police scanner. There was a chip that they would sell that let you listen to cell phone conversations, which I think has been rendered obsolete because they went to a different format or something. But at the time, it was very, you know, and you could turn it on and you go to a certain frequency and it would just keep scanning. Everybody was talking on cell phones would get pulled down onto these scanners. And, you know, a bunch of us had them. And I was addicted to it. I mean, I was completely addicted to it. I wouldn't start, I would have that thing on. I'd have to force myself to turn it off so I could work. But what I would sort of, the self-justification I would indulge in was that, well, I'm from New York, and when I would go out on a street or on a bus, I would hear a lot of voices. I would hear people talking. And now that I'm in Los Angeles, I don't hear anybody talking, so I need this.
Purely medicinal.
Yes, that's right. I had a prescription.
Yeah. Self-prescribed.
This is sort of another practical question. Obviously, you know, if you're lucky enough to have someone want to buy your script, you know, you want to say sayonara on the script. What about if you have a real baby? And I'm afraid, like, there's one that I'm working on that I might take a look at someone and say, you'll butcher that, I don't want to sell it to you, you know. I mean, at what point, if you do this deal and give it to an agent, have you just given up, how can I say, your right to any decisions?
No, well, I mean, it depends. Have you given up any right to make decisions about the making of the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're selling it to them, then basically you are, in practical terms. If you want to, you know, hold out and make it yourself and work with people and raise the money and make this as and be a producer on the movie, then no. But that's a decision you're going to make, you know, it's not an easy decision, and it's one that everybody has to make for themselves about, you know, how important that degree of involvement is for them. And you know, the only thing I'll say is that the more you write, the more you kind of spread that concern out over a broader terrain, let us say. So that when you have one script, that's the script. And then every detail of that script is of enormous significance to you. When you have 5 or 6 scripts, you start compartmentalizing a little bit. And so you're better able to kind of cope with the slings and arrows, you know. This movie that Herzog directed, you know, I had just started to, like, want to make movies instead of TV, you know. And so I got one of the agents that represents me. You know, I just kind of gotten this feature agent instead of a TV guy. And he said, what do you think about Nicolas Cage? And I said, nah, I don't think so. I think he's too predictable. He's too dark and all of this. This seems to be a part you want. Somebody who seems a little more, you know, innocent, fresh-faced. He said, I can see your point. Proceeded to send the movie to Nicolas Cage, who decided to do the movie, and that's why the movie got made. So what the agent understood was what I needed was to get a movie made, and that was more important than what I was, my stated, I guess I would say that if I had all the decisions to make, maybe I would have preferred somebody. I thought Nicolas Cage did a great job. I got to like and know Nicolas Cage. He was terrific in the movie, and the movie's done. And so part of what you start looking to do is, let me get this made so that I'm in a better position to get the next one made. And that sometimes is what weighs a little bit against your certainty about who should be in it, how should it be shot. Not always. I mean, you know, listen, my friend just directed a movie that he wrote about his experiences. He grew up in Boston. He was locked up for 8 years. He got out. He wrote this movie about himself. They wanted to do it. He's an actor. And they didn't want to shoot it in Boston. They wanted to shoot it in Canada. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that, because it's Boston's too important to this movie. And he held out for, I don't know, a couple, 3 years, and he finally got it to direct it himself. He got Ethan Hawke and Mark Ruffalo to be in it, and he shot it in Boston, and it looks and feels exactly the way he wanted to do it. So I don't think he has the slightest bit of regret that he didn't go off and let them do it how they wanted to do it, you know. It depends.
So just quick follow-up on practical, is our agents international, in other words, or is it, you know, you got your U.S. Hollywood agents, and then if you want to go Brit, you got to go get a British agent, or, you know what I mean?
I mean, big agencies generally deal internationally as well. If you're represented by, you know, CAA or ICM or William Morris, they generally have offices around the world, and so they deal in that. I don't know if they work in conjunction with other agents or not. I think it depends on the agent.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That you mentioned about men dreaming.